If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 536, Recontextualization of Identity, with guest Mark Gober, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Monday, January 7th, 2019. So this is my first regular Sea Realm Podcast of the new year. So what you'll hear is basically yesterday's radio show plus a little postscript at the end. But we can't get to the end unless we start at the beginning. Well, you could, but what's the point? Let's go.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
And that is me, KMO. And hopefully on the line, I have an author named Mark Gober. Mark, are you there?
I'm here.
Excellent. The book that I have in my hand is An End to Upside-Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. Mark Gober, welcome to Sea Realm Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So I am looking at SherpaTechnologyGroup.com/team, and I see your face there. And your day job is as interesting to me as the topic of your book, even though the two subject matters seem to be rather distinct. Although you have a longstanding interest in human intelligence because you studied psychology in college, and your academic work, as far as I can tell, focuses on behavioral economics, which is a topic of great interest to me. But your book is fairly far away from that. Let me give you the opportunity to say a few words about what motivated you to write this book.
Yeah, like you alluded to, I think I've always had interest in human thinking and cognition. But it wasn't until around August 2016 that I stumbled across podcasts that exposed me to topics of consciousness, which previously I had not been exposed to too much. And I became very interested. And the long story short is that I ended up researching extensively on my own for about a year before writing the book. So it was a personal interest thing that came up almost spontaneously. But like you said, I think I've always had interests in human behavior and just big questions generally. In fact, I almost majored in astrophysics in college, or I thought about it pretty seriously because I had big questions about existence and the universe. So I think those questions have kind of always been in the background. And for whatever reason, those initial podcasts I heard sparked an interest that led me down a research path.
What were some of those podcasts?
The first one I heard, it was a show called Extreme Health Radio. And at the time, I wasn't looking to listen to podcasts about behavior per se. I was really listening to health and business podcasts. But that show happened to have a woman on because they deal with alternative health, a woman who works with energies. And she talked about communicating with other realms, like communicating with the deceased and the things that I had not really heard of before. She talked about psychic abilities. And her name is Laura Powers, who is a professional psychic energy worker. But at the end of that interview, Laura said that she has her own podcast called Healing Powers, where she interviews other people that have similar experiences. So that, I remember that interested me, and I decided to get her podcast on iTunes, and I would listen to that when I drive to work from San Francisco down to the peninsula where I work. And over the course of a few weeks, I heard her interview many people that were independently describing this picture of reality that was not one that I had ever heard of before. So after hearing a lot of those independent accounts, I started to look at the research, and I was very surprised to see that there was research from the U.S. government, from Princeton University, from the University of Virginia, and from some very credible people that were studying these things.
Now, there's not a whole lot of calendar space between 2016 and now. That seems like a very quick turnaround time to discover a whole new worldview and then write a book on it.
It has happened very quickly. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a casual research endeavor. Let's put it that way. When I wasn't working over that 1 year period, like any time I was out of the office, I was spending my time on this material because I just personally wanted to know. And it wasn't until June of 2017 that I kind of had the idea to put it on paper and summarize it in a book. I had mentioned the ideas to a few friends as I familiarized myself with the research, and they were saying that it was having an impact on how they looked at life because it was such a radical shift versus what we were conventionally taught. So I said, okay, why don't I just try to put it on paper? And I blocked off the 4th of July weekend in 2017, which that year was a long weekend. And I ended up like finishing more than half of a draft and had the rest of it lined up. So I ended up writing the book basically over a few weekends in July 2017, or at least the draft manuscript, and then was fortunate to sign with an agent and a publisher shortly thereafter. So it was a very compressed time frame.
Early in the book, you, I don't want to say criticize necessarily, but you you lay out the weaknesses in the rationalist materialist worldview. If you would say what that worldview is, just to start with, so folks know, you know, what the mainstream view is before we get into an alternative view.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start. My book is called An End to Upside Down Thinking, and I'm often asked, well, what do you mean by upside down thinking? And what I now consider to be upside down thinking is this conventional worldview that you mentioned. It's often called materialism in scientific circles, and that just means the following. And this is certainly what I would have told you I subscribed to before I began my research, and I think it's what's endorsed by academia these days. It says that the universe is fundamentally made of matter. So the universe started 13.8 billion years ago with some event that people often call the Big Bang. And with that event, this universe filled up with physical matter. Like my table's made out of atoms of matter. So we've got matter in this big universe. And because the universe is so big and we have random reactions between those pieces of matter, which we call chemistry, we're bound through chance to end up with a molecule that can replicate itself. We have enough chemical reactions of matter in this big universe. Chance says you'll end up with a molecule that can replicate itself, like DNA. So you've got a planet like Earth, you have DNA. That leads to the evolution of biological organisms, like a human being, which develops a brain. And from the brain comes out consciousness, i.e., like our awareness, our mind. Anyone listening right now has an awareness, a sense of identity that's not a physical thing, and that's what we call consciousness. So the conventional view is that we started with matter, and we ended up with consciousness through a brain. Matter creates consciousness, and more specifically, the brain creates consciousness. That is exactly the view that I'm challenging.
And people who are interested in this line of thinking often invoke the notion of a radio. So more people will listen to this as a podcast over the course of time, but right now, just about everybody listening is listening over the airwaves. So they have a device either in their car or, you know, possibly on a shelf or a table or something in their home, which is picking up the frequency modulations of this FM radio broadcast and translating it into sound waves, which travel from the speaker to their ear, where it is conducted into their brain and then transferred into something harder to describe than sound, you know, sound waves, something with content, something with symbolic content, which means something to them. So as they are listening to me speaking, they're hearing the cadence of my voice, they're hearing the familiar timbre of my voice, but they are also imagining things, which it is remarkable that I can say words here in this studio and people in the nearby community can hear me and share the same thought process. I mean, it seems that at that stage we have moved from something which is easily described as a physical process to something which is not so easy to describe as a physical process. And I would like to take this further, but I'll pause here and see if you have anything to add to the metaphor so far.
Yeah, I think it's a good metaphor. It's one of the ones that I use, and many of the scientists in this area talk about it this way. It relates to that last step in the process of materialism, that the brain is what's producing consciousness. What I didn't realize until I started my research is that science currently doesn't have any understanding how this could happen. We know that the brain has a relationship with our conscious experience, but we don't know how the brain could actually produce it. And Science Magazine has actually called it the number two question that remains in all of science. So what you're alluding to is an alternative framing of the brain and consciousness. Since we know that there is a relationship, like if someone gets in a car accident, they might have memory loss afterwards because they have brain damage. So we can see when you change the brain, you end up changing the conscious experience. The question is that correlation, the correlation between what happens to the brain and what happens to consciousness, is that sufficient to say that the brain then causes consciousness? And we know, at least logically, we can't say that just because two things are related, one is always causing the other. An example from the philosopher Bernardo Kastrup. He says, if you have a firefighter, lots of firefighters show up. If you have a bigger fire, you have more firefighters. In that case, we don't conclude, even though there's a strong relationship, that the firefighters are causing the fire. There's an alternative to explain the relationship. So that might be what's happening with the brain, that the brain isn't producing consciousness, but the brain is almost receiving it, like you were saying, like it's almost a radio receiver, like an antenna. Or the metaphor that I think is a bit more precise is to call the brain to be like a, it's like a filtering mechanism where consciousness exists totally independently of the brain, and the brain is actually limiting what we view of reality. So it's really a reversal of how we think of our biology. Our biology isn't creating our experience. It's actually filtering and processing it so that we see a targeted sliver of reality.
Presumably the sliver of reality that is most useful for us to see in order for us to maintain our bodily integrity and eventually reproduce.
It seems that way. Yeah.
So,
I mean, when we think about just from a conventional standpoint, our eyes only show us a tiny sliver of the electromagnetic spectrum. There's all kinds of light that we don't see. And that's just from a conventional viewpoint. So I think that in general, what's been helpful for me as I've gone through the research is to remind myself, wait a second, our perceptual systems really only show us a tiny bit of reality. So if we want to use that tiny bit to extrapolate on the whole, I think we can be error prone.
So continuing with the radio metaphor, it seems odd to think about it, but a century ago, people were talking about intelligence and using metaphors related to, you know, steam-driven pistons and things of that nature, because that was the technology available at the time. So, though, you know, technological metaphors would be framed using existing technologies. It seems hopelessly crude to us now, but to me, the radio example seems dated. The point of the radio example is that the radio does not create the content that you hear. It picks up something that is generated non-locally and makes it available to you. And the idea is that the brain is doing something similar. Rather than creating consciousness locally, it is somehow picking up on consciousness, which is not necessarily confined to the local area, and making it available to the organism. But, you know, radio is kind of old technology now. And if we were to move on to, say, smartphones as the basis for our consciousness metaphors, well, you know, my smartphone, I've got a data plan. I can also use Wi-Fi to get online and to bring in content from elsewhere. But if there's no Wi-Fi available and I'm in a dead spot, well, there's some stuff on my phone anyway. You know, there's some photographs on my phone. There's some podcasts that I've downloaded, some music that I've downloaded. So there are things stored locally on the phone that it doesn't require a connection to anything, you know, non-material or distant the way that streaming does. And I wonder if perhaps, you know, our biological brains are the same way, that ultimately they are in contact with something that is not local. But at the same time, when they're not in contact in that way, what's going on in the brain is still enough to produce a conscious experience and to sustain, you know, the organism and keep it going through the paces of life so that it stays fed and sheltered and eventually mates.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that the antenna metaphor is a very crude metaphor, and it's helpful in an initial reframing that consciousness is not localized to the body. And I think that helps people quickly capture that idea. Whether there is information that can be stored in the brain when the signal's gone, I think these are the details that really need to be explored of how this works. But to me, the first step is to acknowledge, based on the very large evidence base, most of which that I talk about in my book, that we have to think about consciousness in a new way. We have to think about it non-locally. And then there are nuances like how much is stored even if there's no signal, so to speak. And like if we go to the near-death experience, for example, I have a chapter on that in my book, and there are many reasons to, I think, believe that those are not hallucinations, because what's happening often is a person's having lucid memories and logical thought processes during a time that their brain is completely non-functional, like in cardiac arrest. So there's no blood flow going to the brain, and if there's any brain activity, it's minimal. And the conventional view of the brain would predict we would need to have some serious activity in order to produce the clarity of experiences that are reported. So in those cases, we have a non-functional brain, essentially, and yet we have logical thought processes and memories that seem to be made. So in those cases, which is maybe like the most extreme, we have no brain and yet all of this information that is still occurring. which to me and some others suggest that the brain isn't required at all in some cases for consciousness to be existent. So what you're bringing up is an important question of, like, what is the relationship exactly between the brain and consciousness, and how, if the brain's an antenna or something like it, how is it processing, storing, receiving the information? Those are actually some of the open questions that I talk about at the end of the book and say, look, we don't understand the mechanisms yet, and it's going to be important for us to explore them in science.
It's not my intention to sit and be the naysayer in this conversation, but with the near-death experience, and even in cases where the brain was completely inactive for a time, and yet the person, upon being revived, reports having experience at that time, I think about how when you wake up in the morning and you're sort of half awake, and then you slip back down into a dream, and it seems like you're dreaming for a very long time. Quite a bit happens in the dream, and then you wake up again, and only a couple minutes have passed. It seems to me that that indicates that the brain is capable of generating a lot of memory of subjective experience in a short period of time, and it could be that the person who's being revived is creating all of those memories about what happened when they were dead in that instant, when they're being revived and their brain is once again working.
So I think the biggest counter to that, because that's an argument that some people have made, it's known as the veridical out-of-body experience, and veridical meaning something's verified. So people in the near-death experience often describe hovering over their body and seeing things from a vantage point that is not at their body. And what they describe in the veridical cases is verified as being accurate by those in the room who were not having the near-death experience, which is suggesting that the person was, their consciousness was from an altered perspective, that it's hard to reason in many of those cases that it was created by the brain because of the timing of the experience. It was time stamped when the person should have had no brain functioning. And there's actually a study in Resuscitation Journal, which is a peer-reviewed journal in 2014, that talks about one of these cases where the person had very distinct memories that was time stamped during that time of no brain functioning.
I'm not quite following how a memory can be time-stamped.
Because of the what the person reported as happening, those in the room who were not having the near-death experience, they knew what was happening, when a certain machine was making specific sounds, or when a person was in a certain position. And they knew what the person's biology was because the person was being monitored for cardiac arrest or whatever the issue was. So you can say the person comes back and reports a memory, they know when that thing happened. And then they know what the person's biological functioning was at that time. And it was during a time in which we wouldn't traditionally expect there to be an ability to create memories.
So the question, I think, that naturally follows from the arguments that consciousness is not what we think it is, or not what we are told that it is by supposed experts, what's the practical upshot of that? For example, you've got a section in the book, section 3, wizard-like abilities, scientific evidence. And you have chapters on remote viewing, telepathy, precognition, animal psychic abilities, and psychokinesis, or interacting, but mental interaction with physical matter. I would love to hear about any of those.
So I'll first give a little bit of context of why I have chapters on all of those topics. The way I think about consciousness, or the way I approached it, is that there are a bunch of phenomena that people might call anomalies, meaning that they don't make sense under the traditional view of consciousness, that the brain produces it and the consciousness is just localized to our body and to our brain. Under that perspective, we shouldn't be able to have non-local experiences or psychic abilities. They would not be predicted. And then similarly, things like a consciousness that's functioning when the body's not functioning, whether it's a near-death experience or a child who is having a memory of a life that's not theirs in vivid detail, or communicating with the deceased. These are all things, again, that are suggesting, if they're real, that consciousness is not localized to the body and maybe can function without a body. So the way I approached this whole process was to say, let's look at the evidence cumulatively for all of these phenomena. And if any one of these phenomena is real, then we can explain it much better if we think about consciousness as being primary to matter rather than being a product of matter. And that's what those chapters are about. So I'll start with telepathy. That's mind-to-mind communication. And I think in traditional circles, like in physics, people would say that telepathy is just not possible. Like, how could it be that my thinking can be known in any way by another person's thinking? If consciousness is just this byproduct of the brain that's localized to us, it shouldn't happen that way. But there are a number of studies that have suggested that there is an effect, even though it's sometimes just statistical. And in fact, in 2018, there was an article published in American Psychologist Journal, which is the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Psychological Association. This is a pretty mainstream outlet. And Dr. Etzel Cardenya at Lund University looked at the cumulative evidence for things like telepathy and some of the other phenomena you mentioned and showed that statistically there is an effect beyond chance, and the effect that we see is one that we would accept in other areas of science. So I'll give you an example for telepathy. The study is known as the Gonsfeld experiment, and it's very controversial because of the implications of this, and some people have criticized the experimental protocols. But what I think is interesting about it is that because of the criticisms over the decades, experimenters have been really tight with the protocols, and they're still getting the same result. So the layout is as follows. You have one person in a room, we'll call him Bob, and he's put into a very relaxed state. You have another person in another room, we'll call her Jane. And Jane is shown by the experimenters an image. We'll call it a picture or a video stream, something that she's looking at. And she's told by the experimenters to mentally try to send what she's looking at to Bob in the other room. So Bob doesn't know what Jane's looking at. And Jane doesn't claim to be a superstar telepathic person, but she's going along with it and trying to mentally send what she's seeing. So Bob then comes out of his relaxed state after Jane has been allegedly mentally sending something to her, and Bob is shown four pictures by the experimenters, and the experimenters say one of these four is what Jane was sending you in the other room. Even though you've never seen it, I want you to guess which one it was. So if it were just chance at play, we would expect that over time Bob or the person in Bob's room would guess correctly about 25% of the time, one out of four, because it should be totally random. However, the results suggest that it's closer to 32%. And when you run the statistics on it, it is suggesting that something beyond chance is getting through. So these are average, everyday people not claiming to have extraordinary abilities. It suggests that an average person has a subtle statistical telepathic ability, in a sense. And it kind of conforms with our everyday experience, because if we thought that we were 100% telepathic, then we should know each other's thoughts all the time. But instead, we have these subtle things where we think of somebody and then they text us. It's like, wait, was that random or was there something going on? Many people have had experiences like that, and they might be examples of this 32% versus 25%.
I'd like to bring up the topic of life after death. And I think of it in terms of, say, my dreams. So last night, I had some dreams, and you know they continued up until the moment that I opened my eyes, and in the few seconds after I opened my eyes, the imagery from the dreams was pretty clear, and it faded away, and I have just little fragments of it right now that I couldn't even begin to describe to you. And yet I had an identity when I was in the dream. I had a sense of myself. I knew what my situation was. I knew, what imperatives impinged upon me, what I had to respond to, what I could let slide. And my brain, which supposedly was sustaining, generating all of this experience in the lack of any external stimuli, my brain carries on. It's functioning continues. And yet the identity from the dream is basically obliterated. So I wonder, even if we take at face value the research data, and the findings which indicate that there is something to the idea that consciousness is primary, it doesn't necessarily follow, at least as far as I can see, that one's sense of self and the continuity with our life here on Earth would persist, even if something of the individual continues after the death of the physical body. I wonder what your thoughts are on that idea, of the idea of the persistence of identity.
Well, we have data points here and there, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is to expose how much information is interesting that's out there that's not talked about much, but there are nuances that I think need to be studied more. So in terms of the continuity of a personality, so to speak, I think I would look towards the research at the University of Virginia, and I alluded to this earlier. They've looked for the last 50 years at over 2,500 cases of children, usually between the ages of 2 and 5 years old, who spontaneously start speaking about a life that's not theirs. And in some cases, the details are so specific that the researchers can find a person based on historical records or medical records that is exactly what the child describes. And in some cases, the children have birthmarks and physical deformities that exactly match up with how the person described dying in this previous life. So if we take that to be some kind of continuity of a personality that was in another body that is now seemingly inhabiting the body of a child, that suggests that in some cases there is continuity.
Or it could suggest that the child's personality is not fully formed enough in order to basically fully inhabit the vessel that it's in. But over time, it does grow into itself, basically, and those past life memories fade.
Yes, absolutely. That's what seems to happen, that they do fade, and there does seem to be a process of integration. So it is interesting that it's at the early ages, typically, that these memories are recalled. Although in some less controlled studies, and I don't go into hypnosis in my book, but it's a whole field of past life regression hypnosis, where if people go into a certain meditative state, they seem to be able to recall memories. But the fact that it's happening spontaneously in young children that then they're later forgetting does seem to indicate almost like a transition.
You are listening to Sea Realm Radio. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm speaking with Mark Gober, the author of a book called An End to Upside-Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. Mark, you are certainly somebody who is conversant in, you know, the language of rational materialism and also in scientific inquiry. So you can speak to a particular audience, I think a skeptical audience, in a way that many proponents for these ideas could not. And not sure how this exactly relates to what I want to say, but I've been to the Peruvian Amazon 4 times to drink ayahuasca, hoping to have, you know, encounters with non-human intelligences and visionary experiences and things of that nature, mostly without success. But while I was there, I did have little brushes with what I would consider non-ordinary phenomenon. There was an Australian energy worker who apparently is quite well known, although I can't remember her full name right now. But we were in an art gallery on the second floor, you know, of a busy plaza in Iquitos, Peru, just talking, and she started to pluck with her forefinger and thumb at the air above my wrist, and it seemed to me very much as if she had sort of latched on to my energetic body and pulled it slightly out of alignment with my physical body, just there at the hand. And it, you know, it felt, I knew in an instant that that's what was happening, even though normally I basically operate in the rationalist materialist mindset. So, you know, other times in South America, I've seen glowing orbs sort of zipping around and not necessarily, you know, in conjunction with drinking ayahuasca. So, again, I don't know what that would be. But now that, you know, I'm back in North America and I spend my days online and I spend my days talking to people about economics and artificial intelligence, all of those South American experiences, they just don't seem to fit into my current context. They don't seem particularly relevant. And I haven't had anything approaching an experience like that in many years. So I can have these non-ordinary experiences and yet return to, you know, just the baseline sort of default agreed upon reality of the rationalist materialist mindset. I wonder, it sounds like from what I've heard from your experience so far, that it was encountering rational arguments and experimental data which caused you to question, you know, mainstream Monday morning reality. Is there anything more esoteric in your backstory, or is it really just the arguments that have swayed you over?
Well, initially, before any of the arguments, it was hearing independent anecdotal accounts from people that I just didn't think sounded totally crazy. And when I put them all together, I had a hard time reasoning that every single one of them had a delusion. So that was the – and then, as you said, there was a lot of data research. But I also explored with psychics and energy workers, because if I reasoned that if these things were real, then some people should be able to know things or do things that I can't explain. And there were people that seemed to have abilities that were beyond what a normal person had. And not 100% of the time, but enough where I couldn't reason, I couldn't explain what they were doing with my ordinary explanations. So it was kind of another avenue of research. I don't discuss that in the book as much because it's not really scientific, but it helped me because I was seeing scientific data and anecdotal accounts and then doing things on my own and kind of seeing the same thing. So it all converged to this idea about consciousness not coming from the brain.
Can you hear the train going by?
I heard it.
Yeah, we're right near the tracks here. But I wonder, well, you've studied psychology. You know that in an audio medium like this, where somebody is listening to this conversation, they can't see your face or mine, but they can hear our voices, that stories are much more powerful than arguments in this environment. And I would be very curious to hear any story about the explorations that you did with people, you know, who claim to have non-normal abilities. Is there any encounter or any experience that really left an impression on you?
Yeah. So there were maybe one that is easiest to convey to other people is I spoke with a woman who she claims to be psychic, but she's known as a medical medium, meaning that the things that she sees psychically tend to be due to, around medical issues more than anything else. And this is someone I didn't know at all. It was over the phone. She hadn't seen me in person. And maybe 4 weeks before I talked to her, I didn't have anything specific in mind medically that I was looking for. I just was exploring that I had heard this person and she sounded interesting. But a few weeks before I talked to her, I had kind of like around my neck jaw area from shaving, there was an irritation there. And I wasn't sure if it was from shaving or if it was just kind of a skin dryness. Eventually it went away, but it wasn't something I really thought about much. The reason I mention it is that one of the things she told me over the phone was she said, "Hey, I need you to go in front of the mirror for a second. I want you to point," and she had me basically point to the spot where this irritation used to be, the exact spot. And I wasn't saying anything. And she said, you know, that's, I forget exactly what she said, something like, "You got an inflammatory condition right there," or something. But the fact that she had me go in front of a mirror and point to that exact spot, I mean, at first I didn't realize what she was doing. I said, "Oh my goodness, wait, that's exactly where I had that issue." So things like that are very hard to explain, because you couldn't have known that that was there unless you had seen me over that period of time. And she certainly hadn't, from being across the country.
You know, you say you hear accounts from people who seem sane. They seem lucid. And it just, the explanation that all of these accounts are evidence of, you know, aberrant mental activity, just, it doesn't seem to sync up with your experience of these people. That's something that I hear a lot, though, around the topic of UFO encounters, alien abductions, things like that the people reporting these encounters, they seem like normal, lucid, rational people. And the simplistic explanation that, you know, they just imagined it, or they're lying, or, you know, they've got some undiagnosed neurological issue that's causing this, it just doesn't seem to fly. And yet at the same time, if you look at all of the accounts that people who claim to have encountered aliens, they report, either there are an enormous variety of aliens interacting with humans on Earth, or, you know, there is some element of the fantastic and the fantastical to these accounts, even though the people, you know, providing them don't seem like crazy people.
Yeah, that's one of the difficulties, I think, in the field. When we're dealing with things that are not just statistical effects, like in the lab, we don't see those with our eyes. They're not as they're harder for someone to wrap their head around, I think, when you're just seeing like a deviation of 32% versus 25%. Not as extraordinary. However, when we have accounts of more of just larger scale things, those seem to happen in a more ephemeral manner, where they're reported here and there. They're not easy to capture in a laboratory setting. So those are more difficult. I think the phenomenon of remote viewing, I have a chapter on that. And that's a topic that when I talk about it with people, and I even think about it myself, it's really hard to believe that it's real. Where this is, remote viewing is the ability for someone to perceive at a distance, meaning I'm sitting here in San Francisco and theoretically with my mind, I could see something on another continent that I've never seen before with my eyes. And I could draw it out. The U.S. government had a program for more than 20 years where they used remote viewers to do this kind of activity for psychic spying purposes during the Cold War. So I mention this again because it sounds so extraordinary. I personally haven't had the experience, but this is an area where you have a number of independent accounts that I think when you put them together are super compelling. So one example is that the CIA recently declassified documents from that era, And one of the lines in the internal report that's now publicly available is, remote viewing is a real phenomenon. Implications are revolutionary. And they show all the scientists that looked at this. So when you combine that with the fact that the researchers who were running the studies out of Stanford, like Russell Targ, they've written books on remote viewing and what happened during the program. You combine that with the with what the remote viewers themselves said. You combine it with what people like former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said. He confirmed that remote viewing was used in a certain instance to find a downed Russian bomber that was lost in an African jungle. So, again, we're dealing with something that sounds so extraordinary, but we have independent lenses into it that are all saying the same thing. So to me, that is compelling, even though I've never personally experienced it.
So what would you say is the major upshot in terms of integrating this data into one's worldview? I mean, what somebody who is not necessarily investigating the data, but they do take the time to read your book, what do you think they'll come away with?
I think for the scientific and medical communities, if that's what the person is focused on, this is a revolution in science relative to the mainstream. It means a recontextualizing of a lot of things that we held to be fully true. So in those domains, I think it means a lot because we have to rethink all of our science to be able to account for these phenomena. But beyond that, for an everyday person, the fact that these abilities seem to exist, sometimes more strongly than others, these psychic abilities, that suggests that there's a lot more innate power that we have in our mind than we're traditionally taught. So I think that can be pretty empowering. It's a positive message, I think, in the end. But to me, the biggest implications on a personal level are the notions that, number one, our consciousness might not die when our body dies. That, for me, was a radical shift because I always thought consciousness comes from the brain. When the brain dies, it's over. Your memories are gone. So is there any meaning in life if once you die, you don't have any memories or feelings anymore? If there's some continuity of consciousness beyond the body, then that raises all kinds of questions. So that's a big one. And then another one is the notion of interconnectivity, which I think is an implication that comes up when you look at the combined data, but it's the notion that not only is consciousness more fundamental than matter, but we are sort of entangled as part of the same consciousness. As Erwin Schrodinger, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, said, in truth, there is only one mind. So the idea is that, like Dr. Bernardo Kashyap, the philosopher, has said, that we're like a stream of water, where water represents consciousness, and each of us is like a whirlpool within that stream. So we have our own delineation, so we have a localized experience, but fundamentally, we're connected as part of the same stream of consciousness. That notion of interconnectivity, the idea that we're not as separate as we seem to be, that to me has major, major implications for, at the smallest scale, personal relationships, but also we think about relationships between nations and between societies.
Yeah, one of the things I think about when considering the possibility of the continuity of conscious experience from one body to another is that I am not the same person talking to you, you know, over the phone and the radio here that I will be when I go home to my cat. You know, the person that I'm interacting with or the people and the context have a big impact on, you know, what sort of experiences, subjective experiences manifest for me, you know, what sort of behaviors I engage in. And, you know, if I were to die and then whatever part of my consciousness is not tied to my local biology goes on to some other realm and some other context, that other context might be so different that really there's not much that's recognizable between, you know, that future entity and my current self, you know, here sitting in a room in Vermont in the wintertime talking to somebody in California. And yet, every now and again, I will get a flash of memory from a dream that seems like it's years old, like the concerns that it represents are from a different time in my life. And, you know, the dreams of this morning seem completely irretrievable right now. But, you know, at some unexpected moment, some memory of a dream from a decade ago might present itself, which, you know, suggests that even though I don't have any conscious awareness of those memories that were laid down during the dream, somewhere they are still, they exist and they can be accessed, even if I don't know how.
Yeah, definitely. So there are a few things I would say to that. One is is, at least for me, the way what this research has done is a recontextualization of identity. So even though it feels like our identity is the body and the thoughts sometimes, I now think of our identity as being the consciousness that experiences the body, the consciousness that experiences the thoughts, the consciousness that experiences the memories. So even though the content of experience shifts, the experiencer, this kind of non-physical subjectivity, that is seems to be unchanging. So that's what I mean by consciousness and identity. So that's been a shift for me. But your question about memories, it's a really important one. I mean, I think it's not well understood even in conventional science. It's like, how does the brain interact with memories, and how could it be that we just kind of spontaneously remember something that we had seemingly forgotten? What is the way that we access memory? And if the brain's like an antenna, as a crude metaphor, is it like the brain just kind of tunes into a certain frequency? And is there some trigger to that that allows us to access this non-physical memory that exists? These, to me, are some of the big questions that need to be explored further. And this recontextualization of the brain might help us understand the answers.
I'd like to shift focus now to something closer to your day job. You work with the Sherpa Technology Group, and you advise companies about technology and intellectual property, and you are located in Silicon Valley. So you can't help but hear about rapid advances in data science and artificial intelligence and the ability of AI, whatever that means, to interact with huge data sets, which, you know, we human beings are generating just by interacting with our technology all day, every day. And this whole notion of artificial intelligence, for me, brings up the question of, you know, is there anything, any similarity between our experience of being intelligent entities and the ability of machines to solve complex problems without any indication whatsoever that they have a subjective experience of their own? You know, they seem to be intelligent in certain domains, but they have no sense of self, no experiential stream. What's in your opinion, or, you know, in light of your research, what is the similarity, or is there any similarity, between so-called artificial intelligence and organic, spontaneous human intelligence?
To me, there is an important difference, and you were hinting at it, which is that we have this kind of subjective inner experience of being alive. We have a subjective experience of identity, and that's beyond just computation, the sense of self. Can a machine have that? Can a machine spontaneously spawn a new consciousness? Like, if we make a computer complex enough, will a consciousness magically emerge from the machine so that they would have the same kinds of sense of self that we do? I would argue that consciousness isn't coming from matter. So by creating a complex machine, we won't create new consciousness, because that's not where consciousness comes from in the first place. So the way I look at AI is that we can create incredibly complex algorithms and complex computers that can do things, but they will, until we understand how even a human brain is relating to consciousness, it's going to be difficult for us to replicate that in a machine. So to me, many of the fears of AI, which say that, you know, like the show Westworld, where the machines start to have feelings at a certain level of complexity, they have memories, and then they like take over. It's like a doomsday scenario. That to me is far-fetched, in that I don't see consciousness emerging from matter at this stage. So if we're concerned about AI, which I think we should be to some degree, the concern should be more about those who are programming the artificial intelligence. Like, we could create an algorithm that tells a machine to do bad things, and that is the danger. So to me, the danger is more in the programmer than in the fact that the machines could spontaneously emerge their own consciousness.
I forget who said it now, but recently I heard somebody express the idea as, I'm not worried about the machines failing to do what we tell them to do. I'm more concerned that they will do exactly what we tell them to do.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And mostly what we're asking them to do is solidify social control and concentrate wealth.
Yes. And for now, as long as we're programming them not to shoot at people, or, you know, to do things that we would all consider to be harmful, AI can be extremely helpful. And in Silicon Valley, I see many companies that are developing important technologies that will enhance our lives. So it is an important balance. like I think with any technology, there are pros and cons, and we just have to be mindful of the potential dangers.
Well, what are some of the areas of artificial intelligence that give you, you know, reason for optimism? What do you see as being the most valuable applications on the near
horizon? There's a lot of things in society that are manual tasks that machines can easily do and allow human beings to spend more time on other topics and use our brains more and expand our minds more rather than doing menial tasks. So I think that's one general area. But also the computational power that we're seeing in computing in general is going to help us, I think, look at data, as you said, in new ways, and to explore things in ways that we couldn't have conceived of before because of this ability of computation.
You know, when you relieve a human being of the need to perform a repetitive physical task through automation, in our current economic environment, you are also relieving them of the burden of their income, which they need. Do you see any grand reorganization of our basic economic fundamentals, you know, in the corporate capitalist West, in order to accommodate what AI is going to make possible in the near future?
There might need to be naturally, if it's essentially a shift in how the economy is working, where certain jobs are effectively displaced by artificial intelligence, then those people will need to utilize different skills and different types of jobs. So it might just mean a recalibrating of how our workplace is distributed across different jobs. Certain jobs that exist now might not exist, and people will develop new skills, hopefully over time.
Yeah, I'm particularly dubious whenever discussion of technological unemployment leads to the topic of job training. You know, that somebody who is middle-aged right now and has very little experience with, the technologies which will be the hot job properties of the future, that they are somehow going to, you know, get a go to night school or something and get some sort of certificate which is going to bootstrap them into a completely different industry in middle age, you know, competing against people who are fresh out of college and with much younger, nimbler biological brains. You know, the whole education is the answer to me is it's uncompelling, to say the least.
Yeah, well, I think you're right that for certain demographics, it will be a difficult transition. But hopefully, in many cases, people have a diversity of skills that they'll just have to, if they're not willing to learn new things, that they can apply their current skills to other areas that have not been displaced yet. But I think you're right. There's probably a lag period where the economy is shifting based on artificial intelligence capabilities, and there might be certain people that are displaced, and it's not, for those people, it's not a positive transition, but maybe for society as a whole, we see a generally positive trend.
Yes, when the topic comes up, people who tend to be either technophiles or, you know, their income and their wealth is dependent on current trends in technology, they'll look to past transitions, like the transition from, you know, an agrarian society to one that is based on manufacture in centers, you know, like in cities. They'll say, well, look, it turned out fine, but it didn't turn out fine. It was really a traumatic and terrible experience for thousands of people who never did adjust to the new normal. And it's only okay now because those people are long dead. So, you know, if the it's all going to work out fine argument means that people suffering from lack of, you know, purpose and lack of income and lack of dignity that comes from, you know, supporting oneself and one family, if it's all going to be okay because those people eventually will die, well, that's not much of a comfort. And ethically speaking, I'm not terribly impressed with, you know, arguments that run along those lines. Not that you're making that exact argument.
It's definitely an issue. I think you're totally right.
Let's return, I suppose, to the strange or the esoteric. Artificial intelligence is showing us that we can have complex behavior and meaningful problem-solving behavior and interaction with the environment by an entity which itself has no subjective experience. And that brings to mind an idea that I heard articulated on a podcast many, many years ago, which is that most of the human beings walking around in the world don't have any sort of subjective experience, that the ensouled beings are actually a minority. And the new complex behaviors that we're seeing in machine intelligence seem to give rise, or they seem to give credence to the possibility that you can have complex, even social behavior from creatures that basically have no inner life. You know, the so-called philosophical zombies, the people who seem to be there, but really the lights are on and nobody's home.
So you're suggesting that some people who are just human beings are effectively not conscious. Is that the argument that you're making?
That is the it's the argument that I'm reporting.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not one that I would stake my reputation on or want to, you know, be primarily associated with. But it is something that nags at my consciousness.
Yeah. So I've heard this argument before, and I think if we want to get to the point of proof of anything, if we want to be super skeptical, the only thing that we could ever prove is that I am having a conscious experience right now. That's it, and everything else is an inference. If we take that logic and say, okay, given that I am conscious and I know what my behaviors are like, if I see others that are acting in a similar way, it is very reasonable to assume that they are also conscious without any reason to doubt that, and without evidence to the contrary. It's a reasonable assumption, given that I am conscious and act a certain way, that those people, because they're acting a certain way, also have consciousness. And that's probably, I'm not sure how else to look at it other than that. I don't think it can be proven because right now I'm only in my own consciousness. So, yeah, I guess it's possible that another person is a philosophical zombie or something like that, a biological zombie. But given the way they're acting and given the way that I experience my own consciousness, I think it's a reasonable inference to assume that others are conscious.
Well, if 20 years ago I had said to some unseen presence, Alexa, what's the temperature? And a female voice in pleasant tones said, the temperature in Bellows Falls is 38 degrees Fahrenheit. It would have been a rock solid, safe inference for me to say that the person to whom I spoke and who retrieved that information and gave it to me understood my question.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing you could point to in the world that would be an instance of something understanding spoken language and responding to it appropriately without understanding what has been said. And yet, you know, what would have been true and rock solid 20 years ago is demonstrably untrue now. Alexa doesn't understand anything. You know, she doesn't know anything. But in response to spoken commands, this system, which I am calling she, but which is really, you know, genderless, responds appropriately without any understanding, which, you know, to me raises the specter of complex, seemingly knowledgeable behavior from entities which have no subjective experience.
Right. And I guess maybe it would get to the point of having to really push that entity to get it to the point where maybe it's not responding like a human being would respond, to really test the boundaries of it.
Which is easy to do with Alexa.
Right.
You can
right.
get her to inappropriate or inappropriate responses very easily.
Yes. Maybe when we get to the point where Alexa is so much like a human where we have difficulty with those boundaries, then I don't know. These are tough philosophical questions that people have looked at for a long, long time.
I was at a party over the holidays, and there was somebody there who's, you know, works in technology, and we got to talking about artificial intelligence, and in particular, the Amazon Alexa. And somebody else was saying, you know, how lifelike Alexa was and how, you know, how very convincing it was, you know, that there was somebody there, that the lights, not only were the lights were on, but there is somebody home inside that little Alexa device. And I was saying, well, you know, they have this annual chatbot competition where Amazon pays prizes to the three teams that come up with the best chatbots. And you can just, you know, just say, Alexa, let's chat. And you can get into one of those chatbot routines. And they are supremely unconvincing. I mean, I'm so majorly underwhelmed by the ability of, you know, that device to present itself as, you know, an entity with subjective experience, with a sense of self. It's so clearly, it can't remember what you were talking about 2 seconds ago. It doesn't know who it's talking to. It doesn't retain any conversational context at all. And yet, a machine that can just understand the difference between spoken yes and spoken no, and be able to understand or, you know, respond appropriately to you saying 1, 2, 3, or 4, can destroy whole sectors of employment, you know, telephone operators.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take impressive levels of, you know, cognitive simulation to wreak havoc on our economic system and in our daily life, even though, you know, Alexa is nowhere near being sentient.
That's right. That's right. And we can only imagine what happens when it exceeds that minimal amount of complexity and what it could be displacing.
Well, I think we're on the same page in that the frightening thing is not what a fully aware and sophisticated artificial intelligence is going to do with its newfound powers. The more immediate danger and the more relevant danger is what human beings will have these entities do long before they develop their own sense of, you know, what's right in the world or what's worth doing.
That's how I see it. Yeah, the danger is in the programmer, and then whatever, like you're saying, the societal ripplings of employing this technology and how that will affect those in the workplace.
Well, we've got just a little bit less than 4 minutes left in the hour. Is there anything from the book that you'd like to return to or maybe touch on again?
We've talked about continuity of consciousness a little bit, and I mentioned the near-death experience. But we haven't talked about communications with the deceased, which is something that's been reported for a very long time. And in the 1800s, there were some pretty compelling cases of individuals that seemed to have abilities to communicate with the deceased. They're typically called mediums. And people like William James, the famous psychologist, there was someone that that he investigated very closely and discovered that he thought she could do something and was able to get information that he couldn't explain. What's interesting to me is that in the last decade or so, and maybe a bit before, scientists have started to explore mediumship in a controlled manner. And the Winbridge Research Center is one such institution that's looked at this. And they've actually published two peer-reviewed journal papers where they used five levels of blinding on mediums who were speaking to the researcher over the phone. And all the researcher gave was the first name of the deceased person. And statistically, the medium in both of those studies was able to get information about that person, that deceased person, beyond chance. So that to me is another super interesting area of the continuity of consciousness. If mediumship is real, if we can really communicate and get information about a deceased person.
Have you seen the movie Hereditary?
I have not.
It's about this very topic of mediumship and non-material entities basically taking up residence in living human bodies. I do not normally go in for horror films, but this one made lots of people's, you know, top 10 for the year list. So I watched it last night, and I kind of wish I could unmake that decision. I don't like supernatural horror. I like to keep my mind clear of those images, you know, and particularly the ones which are so skillfully paired with sustained tension, psychological tension. Not a recipe for a happy experience for me.
I'm going to pass on that one. I appreciate the warning.
Yeah, it's a good movie that you may well have good reason to not see.
Okay. Good to know.
All right, so just a minute and a half left. Again, the title of your book is The End to Upside-Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. Is there a website or any other project you'd like to make people aware of?
My website is my name, markgober.com, markgober.com, and that has more information on me and my book, An End to Upside Down Thinking. And the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and many other bookstores. I'm also working on a podcast in which I've already interviewed nearly 50 of the scientists and people that have had these experiences, that many of whom I discuss in my book. And hopefully some in the first half of this year we'll still working on a date, I'll be releasing the podcast. So I'm hoping that for people that are interested in these topics, it will be a new way to absorb the data, to actually hear from the scientists and the practitioners themselves.
Well, I hope you'll come back and do another C-Realm radio appearance when the podcast is about to premiere.
I would love to. I appreciate that.
All righty. Well, we're down to like 20 seconds, so I'm going to have to bid you goodbye. But Mark Gober, it has been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
On the C-Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back to its old dimensions.
All right, so what did you think of that conversation with Mark Gober? I was pleased with it and pleasantly surprised, and I'll tell you why. His publicist sent me a copy of his book, but I didn't get very far in reading it. Not because it's a bad book, just because I have poor reading habits these days, I'm afraid.
too much electronic competition. But in the past, when I have accepted guest suggestions from paid publicists, sometimes it's been okay, and sometimes it's been a real drag. And in fact, some of those episodes have been the ones where it's really, for me, just an exercise in being polite with somebody who I don't find to be very interesting. You know, but still, I'm committed to an hour of radio with them, and just, you know, I'm going to make the best of it. You know, sometimes guests who come at the behest of their paid publicists, and, you know, the initial contact comes from the publicist, sometimes they're okay, but for the most part, I consider my taking those sorts of guest suggestions to be a compromise with my own disorganization and laziness, really. Most of what goes into doing a podcast is something other than speaking into a microphone. The technical side of things, you know, depending on your aptitudes, can be quite challenging, or, you know, can be just routine. But in any event, it does take time and effort and focus and attention and mental energy. But there's also the producer side. You know, a producer does a variety of things, but one of the most time-consuming things, really, and the one that's really largely kind of thankless, is scouring the web looking for potential guests. And what's more, if that guest is promoting something, I don't always get it done, but I do feel a duty to actually, you know, read their book or watch their movie or listen to their podcast or, you know, whatever it is they have on offer, I feel obligated to familiarize myself with it. Now, there are some loopholes and some escapes there. I mean, if I'm talking to somebody who's written a book on a topic, which, you know, I haven't read their book, but I've read five other books on that topic, well, then I don't feel so bad. But what I didn't get from the early pages of Mark's book, which I think is pretty important, which I discovered in actually talking to him, is that he is, you know, quite conversant in the language that I'm most at home in. You know, the worldview, the idiom that I find easiest to navigate, which is, you know, the materialist scientific worldview. Obviously, it's not the only worldview that I'm open to, on the level of willingness anyway. Seems I am somewhat close to it just by, I think, either my genetic inheritance or possibly the environment in which I live is it closes off certain avenues of exploration and perception. And also, I think, just as a matter of choice, I'm living, you know, as the song says, in the material world. But Mark, as I say, speaks my language and can speak to topics that I find interesting, and that makes me much more willing to engage, you know, in the realms where I'm less certain, where I feel like I have less at the ready in terms of, you know, informed observations. The podcast that I was recapping when I said that, you know, artificial intelligence showing us that complex behavior can arise in the total absence of subjective experience, and how that made me think of a podcast that I'd listened to many years ago. It really was many years ago. It was probably 2009 when I heard this podcast. It was one of Jason Horsley's early podcasts. The podcast was called Stormy Weather. And I don't know how many episodes that ran, like not more than 30 or 40, I don't think. And this was one of the final ones. It may have been, in fact, the final episode of Stormy Weather. I don't know if it's still archived and still available. I would be interested to revisit it. It would be interesting to hear it, you know, some 10 years later. All right, I'm not going to keep you here all day. I mean, I know some of you wouldn't mind, but others of you have busy lives and lots of media to consume, so I'm just going to finish off by reading a letter. This is an actual two pieces of paper that came to me in an envelope. That sort of letter. It's from John S., who writes, "Dear KMO," and I'm going to skip the part where he apologizes for sending a check for so little. I mean, so few people send a check that it's absolutely absurd to apologize for the amount. Moving on, though, John writes, "I really appreciate your interviewing style and many of the guests you have on. Toward the end of episode 533, where you interviewed, spoke with Joshua D. Glosson, you both touched on two subjects dealing with military/intelligence agencies' financial and convenient relationships with Hollywood and Silicon Valley, as it were. If at some point you'd be interested in following up on those subjects, I would like to suggest you interview Tom Secker of SpyCulture.com and the Clandestine podcast. You can find his website at this URL, www.spyculture.com. He covers a lot of territory. As you mentioned, the Department of Defense will fund some movies, quite a few actually, via their Entertainment Liaison Office. All branches of the armed forces have their own individual ELOs, that is, Entertainment Liaison Offices, as do intelligence agencies, CIA, FBI, et al. Their involvement goes beyond just funding, as they also have a large impact on scriptwriting as well. None of this, of course, is just recent history, but dates back quite some time. On the Silicon Valley front, there is a recent book that I haven't read yet, but will over the winter, and that's Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. The book would be more in line with Mr. Glosson's take in your conversation with him. Here's an overview. In this fascinating book, investigative reporter Yasha Levine uncovers the secret origins of the internet, tracing it back to a Pentagon counterinsurgency surveillance project. A visionary intelligence officer, William Godel, I don't know if that's Godel or Girdle, as in Kurt Girdle, but we'll say Godel for now. A visionary intelligence officer, William Godel, realized that the key to winning the war in Vietnam was not outnumbering the enemy, but using new information technology to understand their motives and anticipate their movements. This idea, using computers to spy on people and groups perceived as a threat, both at home and abroad, drove ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, to develop the internet in the 1960s and continues to be at the heart of the modern internet we all know and use today. As Levine shows, surveillance wasn't something that suddenly appeared on the internet. It was woven into the fabric of the technology. But this isn't just a story about the NSA or other domestic programs run by the government. As the book spins forward in time, Levine examines the private surveillance business that powers tech industry giants like Google, Facebook, and Amazon, revealing how these companies spy on their users for profit, all the while doing double duty as military and intelligence contractors. Levine shows that the military and Silicon Valley are effectively inseparable, a military digital complex that permeates everything connected to the internet, even co-opting and weaponizing the anti-government privacy movement that sprang up in the wake of Edward Snowden. With deep research, skilled storytelling, and provocative arguments, Surveillance Valley will change the way you think about the news and the device on which you read it. In closing, best wishes over the holiday. Be well. John S. P.S. Another good title is Policing America's Empire, The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State by Alfred McCoy, a dense history of how the U.S. surveillance state came into being. McCoy wrote the seminal book, The Politics of Heroin, The CIA's Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. All right, so, you know, my New Year's resolution for 2019 is to upload something to YouTube every day. And the idea is to get this down to, a manageable chunk of content creation that I can do every day, like, you know, within an hour. From jotting down, you know, any strategizing notes to actually recording, to editing, to uploading and getting it posted, I'd like to get all of that down to an hour. And you'd think that would be a trivial assignment for a product that's, you know, 10 minutes long or less, but that's just not the case. But anyway, I think that resolution in and of itself is enough for 1 year. So it'll have to wait for 2020 for my New Year's resolutions to turn, I think, to the problem of reading or the lack of book reading in my life right now. There are a lot of good books out there, and some of the best podcast conversations come from speaking with an author after having actually read their entire book cover to cover. And doing that requires reading. And reading in a world that includes computer games and the internet and YouTube and contact with people from all over the world, well, finding time to read books requires a bit of discipline, at least at first, even for a lifelong reader like me. All right, well, I've mentioned the YouTube videos. I know that a lot more people listen to this podcast than watch those videos, so I would invite you to check them out. If you're having trouble finding my YouTube channel, which if you're starting on YouTube, it can be difficult, I hate to say it, but this works. Just do a search for Humans Suck. You will find one of my antinatalism videos. Or you could go to my Patreon page. It's patreon.com/KMO. You don't have to be a Patreon supporter in order to see some of the content that I post there. And also, again, more people listen to this podcast than read my weekly webcomic. It's called Geb. It's G-E-B-B, or Golf Echo Bravo Bravo. And it's about aliens living in an underground base in Antarctica who think the job that they are assigned to do here on Earth is pointless and stupid, but deciding to do something else above their pay grade. So they do what they can to find some meaning in their existence, while performing alienated labor. I hope you'll check that out because, as I've mentioned before, I get paid to do that comic and I want that job to stick around. I look forward to continuing this story, and I know that I won't do it without the weekly paycheck that comes with it. So do check it out. The website is geb.io. Again, that's G-E-B-B, Golf Echo Bravo Bravo .io, as in Indian Ocean or Input Output. All right, pimping of other projects complete. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.